You're listening to episode 104 of 88 Cups of Tea with Yin Chang.
Am I doing this right? Hi, I'm your host, Yin Chang, and thanks for joining me on 88 Cups of Tea. This podcast is created to leave you feeling motivated from interviews with storytellers, where we learn how they create opportunities for a successful career without losing sight of the values that make us human. Whew, that was a really long run-on sentence.
Hey, storytellers! A very warm welcome to our new 88 Cups of Tea listeners. As a quick overview of our podcast, I interview really inspiring and awesome storytellers in hopes that their personal experiences and advice will shake you out of your funk and make you feel less alone. For all of my listeners who've been with us for a while, thank you so much for hanging out with us every week, and a massive hug to our listeners who recommended and shared our podcast with friends and took the time to leave us iTunes ratings and reviews. We recently received an awesome review from the username RenBirdsF, who rated us 5 stars and wrote, "For an inside look at the world of writing and publishing, it's hard to beat this podcast. Some of the most highly respected authors, agents, and publishing professionals weigh in on what it takes to create exciting, meaningful work and help it find a home out in the world. And did I mention the food? Mouth-watering dishes and drinks seem to find their way into these epic episodes, too. Thank you so much for that lovely review. Now, if you're looking for a sense of family with a bunch of people who understand the highs and lows of being a writer, you should seriously join our private Facebook group at facebook.com/groups/88cupsoftea. I love this community of ours, and I always have the best time checking in to hear how everyone is doing. We check in almost every day to talk about our work in progress, our latest achievements, current reads, and so much more. We seriously have the most encouraging and supportive members in our group, so you don't want to miss out on this special community. Come over and hang out with us at facebook.com/groups/88cupsoftea. In today's new episode, we have a highly motivating roundup of interview clips from guests we've had on the show over the past 2 years. There's so much that's been going on around us and an overwhelming amount of devastating news lately, and it's honestly no surprise that there are many of us hitting a wall with our creativity. I've been keeping a close eye on our community, and some of you have not been able to write lately, and several have been feeling stuck for quite some time now. So I went through some of your top favorite and most popular episodes to pull out highlights I found would be most helpful for you right now and hopefully give you a massive boost of inspiration. In the roundup, you'll be hearing clips from interviews with Jacqueline Woodson, Victoria V.E. Schwab, Rita Williams-Garcia, Jeff Centner, Angie Thomas, and Leigh Bardugo, in that specific order, by the way. We talk about writing as a catharsis to push through grief, facing self-doubt, making time for writing, and learning to fall back in love with your writing. I hope that after you listen to this episode, it feels like a warm, tight hug for your soul, and anytime you hit a rough spot again with your writing, I encourage you to re-listen to this episode to remind you that you are not alone. Now let's jump right in.
Is there a moment that you can share with us? And you know, as writers, there are many moments where we face a lot of lull moments, whether it's like the longest writer's block in the world or something may have happened personally that affected or we felt like crippled us with our inspiration for writing or created a fear and a wall and a barrier. Has that ever happened to you? And if it has, how did you overcome it so that whoever's going through it listening to this can also find some inspiration from it?
Oh, another really good question. I would have to say the first time it happened was during 9/11 when I was pregnant with Toshi, my daughter, and trying to get back to New York where I live and not knowing who had lived or who had died and just being really, really afraid and knowing that my world was changed forever. It was changed forever and it was going to keep changing. And to be in that moment of bringing a child into a world where that had just gotten that devastated was so terrifying. And writing seemed to be so unimportant compared to the enormity of things going on. And when I started writing again, it was to have a catharsis. Writing felt like the only thing I had the power to do. And so I wrote myself through it. And I feel like, you know, I wrote Behind You, I wrote Showway, I wrote Locomotion, I wrote all of those books through the grief of 9/11. And then when I was writing Brown Girl Dreaming and my mom had just died suddenly, and I realized I had all these questions I wanted to ask her. And, you know, now she wasn't there to ask. And I interviewed relatives and I interviewed my dad and I interviewed my aunts and stuff and just found out who she was before she was my mom. And there was so much healing in that. And the thing that has stopped me from writing has also been the thing that has made me start writing again.
She was talking about self-doubt, and she wants to know if you felt it, and it's clear that, you know, from our conversation that you have before, but what do you do to get past it? Yeah, whatever you want to dish out with that.
I have this incredible ability to retcon my memory so that in the midst of writing something, it's hell and I feel incapable. And then as soon as it's done, I'm like, that was amazing, guys. That was so much fun. Only in that I'll start the next project and start bemoaning it. And I'll think, oh my God, why can't this be easy like the project before? At which point, all of my friends and family will look at me and will they be like, are you high? And then they will show me the receipts. They will show me the emails and the phone calls and everything that I inundated them with for 6 months before when everything was miserable. So part of it is honestly just understanding the cycle of lies that your brain tells yourself. I will never escape self-doubt. In fact, the more books I write, the harder it gets to write a first draft. The reason being, the more aware you are of what's wrong. But the simple fact remains, whether you're writing your first book or your 13th book, which is the one that I just finished, you cannot fix a blank page. So it's not about getting over self-doubt and more about the sheer fact that I can't make it better if I don't make something to start with. I'm going to hate it. The whole time I'm writing that first draft, I'm going to hate it. I might forget I hate it for like 5 minutes at a time. But like most of all, I'm going to hate it. And then the revision process is this narrowing between the idea in your head and the thing on paper and slowly, slowly erasing your self-loathing of the book. But no, self-doubt is a continuous companion. Now, there's a really important difference between self-doubt and the little red flag in your head that says this book has taken a wrong turn. One of those things you don't listen to and the other one you do. You have a little voice in your head that you train with the story monster technique, and you will start to get a gut feeling when the book is gone wrong. That is not self-doubt. That is your brain or your heart or something trying to tell you that you have gone astray. And that part, so much of this business, so much of this process is learning to differentiate between self-loathing and self-doubt and that voice that is actually valid, which is a self-editor. And that just comes with trust. That comes with learning your process, learning your voice, learning all of these things. But self-doubt is your albatross. It is your constant companion and you will never get rid of it. And the day that it's no longer there, you have done something wrong. I asked one of my writing heroes a couple of years ago, Neil Gaiman. I asked him, I said, do you still feel self-doubt? This is a man who has been published for 35 years, who is one of the science fiction and fantasy's golden children.
Yeah, I mean, he's freaking massive, yes.
And he said, every blank page. So understanding that it is part of the tribe. You will never, it is a waste of time to get rid of self-doubt. What you're trying to do is drown it out with other things. But it's a voice that's going to be there the whole time.
If there is a time where you felt really stuck in a rut or you felt like you couldn't get yourself out of a certain situation, could you please share that moment with us and how you got yourself out of it?
Okay, so I'm going to talk about my novel, Jumped. It took me close to 2 years to write that novel. I envisioned it one way, and the more I wrote, the more I hated it. I hated the characters. They all sounded the same. I didn't like them. I didn't like the story. There was nothing about the story that I liked. It took a while, but I had to create whole and separate characters. Well, as whole as they were going to be, because this book is partly satire. And so the characterizations are not terribly deep, but each person is their own person, and I had to begin to respect that. And it really took me a long time to find an in with each character and to really crystallize that the shape of the novel. I knew what it was I wanted to do. It was very hard for me to open up and to let it be just a little bit more in some places and a lot less in others. And so it was just a constant battle the novel was about one girl knowing another girl was going to beat up a third girl. Well, all three of those girls conspired to beat me up as I was writing and rewriting. It took many drafts to get it right. And when I finally had it, I knew it immediately. But it really took going through all of those layers, all of those drafts to really get the story and to trust it.
How the hell do you make time between being a prosecutor and an author? How?
Really, the secret is just making the most of the time that I do have. So that means that instead of driving to work, which would be a lot quicker than taking the bus, I take the bus into work and I write on the bus. So I have about a 35 or 40 minute commute each way. And on those two commutes, I can generally do about 500 words, maybe even 1,000 words if I really get on a tear and really plan out what I want to say. And I'll also sometimes write over my lunch hour at work. I do a lot of planning in my head so that I don't waste time when I go to write. I don't just sort of fly by the seat of my pants because I don't have time to do that. I'll go for a walk at night when I get home from work, and that's kind of my planning time. And I think about what I want to say. I think about where I want to go with my next scene, things like that. It's really about when it's working time, it's working time. And I like don't check the internet. I really just buckle down and get it done. And if you write at the rate of 1,000 words a day, that's 60,000 words in 2 months. You know, that's basically a book. I mean, The Serpent King is 77,000 words and Goodbye Days is 88,000 words. If you write clean and you write clear, and in my day job too, I do a ton of writing. I write all day in my day job, 8 to 4:30 every day. I just write. I'm always working on deadlines there. I've gotten a lot of practice in getting it right the first time and getting it clean and clear and saying what you want to say the first time, because I just don't have time to fumble around. So
yeah. Okay, we have a lot of listeners who are parents, and they're struggling with, not really struggling, but it's not exactly the easiest, let's just say, like having to come home after work, having kids to take care of. Like, you know, obviously you want to spend as much time as possible with your children as well, but also make time for your own passion and your art. It's inspiring just to hear how other people do it and just figure out time. It's nice to kind of shake up your routine as well and just, hey, let me try what Jeff said, and let me try taking the bus or train into work and scheduling those 30 minutes or block out those 40 minutes in transit to write my story. That was really, really helpful.
That's one of my big missions in life, is to hopefully impart to people this idea that you can be creative around the edges of a normal life. Mm. You can be creative and have a day job. In fact, I think it helped. I don't know that I would want to be a full-time writer. I mean, I guess it would be nice to sell that many books that I could be a full-time writer. But honestly, I don't think I would do any more writing if I were a full-time writer. I would do more reading. Yeah, I would really just read a lot more books. I wouldn't do any more writing, I think, than I currently do now. And I think the writing I would do would be harder because I would have economic considerations driving my writing. As it stands right now, I don't think about what's going to sell when I write.
Interesting.
I think about telling the best story. Whereas I know myself well enough to know that if I didn't have a source of income that was such that I could never write another book and I could still feed my family, I could still put a roof over our head, if I didn't have that and had to depend on my imagination to provide that, I would come to resent my imagination. I would come to view my imagination as something I'm fighting against for survival. I'm not bohemian, devil-may-care personality like, oh, a bluebird will bring the rent check in through the window next month. It will be fine. I really focus on material survival first and foremost. If there's any question about my financial situation, my state of survival, where the next meal is going to come from, where the next rent check is going to come from, all of my energy goes towards solving that problem. And none of it would be left over for writing. So I just absolutely have to have either a day job or I have to be selling books like James Patterson to where I would never have to write another book and I would be completely fine. One of those two I would have to be able to create art.
Your writing is so powerful. I need to know, writing-wise, this is your debut novel. I find insane. What inspired you to write this book?
Thank you for saying all these awesome things. This is the best way to start the week, so thank you.
You're going to hear a lot more rolling in, okay? So you better get used to it. I'm just massaging this in.
I got the idea for the book back in 2010, 2011. I was a senior in college, and that was after the shooting death of Oscar Grant in mm-hmm. Oakland, California. He was a young Black man who was killed by police. At the time, I was a lot like Star, actually. I was attending a mostly white, upper-class, conservative Christian college. I just threw a whole bunch of words in there. But that's the perfect way to describe it. And I lived in the hood. It was a 10-minute drive between my school and home. But mm-hmm. in those 10 minutes, I went between two totally different worlds. I would literally cross a bridge and go from the hood to the nice neighborhood. Being in those two different worlds, I heard two different conversations about Oscar. At home, he was one of our own, but at school, he may have deserved it. Instead of burning down the entire campus of my school, I wrote the short story that would later become The Hate U Give. When I was doing it as a short story, it was a part of my senior project. Every week, I would have to turn in a little piece here and there for my professor to basically show that I was actually working on it. Every time I would turn something in, he would pull me aside and he would say in his deep Southern accent, "Darling, you're going too far with this." And at first I'm thinking, what do you mean I'm going too far? Keep in mind, this is older white gentleman. So I'm like, what do you mean I'm going too far? But no, what he meant was I was adding too many characters and too many plot details for a short story. He said, "This would make a darn good novel one day."
I was bracing myself like, oh no, he didn't. Let me let Angie finish. And I'm glad I did. So he was the one who encouraged you to make this a full-fledged novel.
Yeah, he did. Honestly, because it was such an emotionally and mentally draining book, I put it aside for a couple of years. I didn't get back to it until maybe 2014, early 2015, because that was after Trayvon happened and after Michael Brown happened and after Tamir Rice. And I'm seeing all of these cases and I'm feeling the same anger, frustration, hurt, and fear. The only thing I knew how to do was write. So I picked it back up and here we are now. I'm still amazed. I really am.
That's incredible. And now when you said that you were writing this, that was your way of expressing how you felt after what happened to Oscar Grant. With the short story originally, was that something that just flowed out naturally? There are a lot of writers who just write on their own. And there's other writers who almost like journal style diary entries. And there's others who throw themselves in workshops and find critique partners and writing mentors to work on what they're working on. What was your route?
I just sat down and wrote. I got the idea of this young girl who was in the middle of this situation, being in these two worlds like I was at the time. And I got the idea for Khalil. Actually, Khalil came first because I remember seeing with Oscar Grant. Oscar was an ex-con and he used to sell drugs. That seemed to be what most people were focusing on instead of him and the fact that he lost his life. And I remember because I saw so many Oscars around me every single day, I wanted to tell their story. So I was getting all of these ideas about Khalil and about Star and even about Star's dad, because those were the three characters I came up with first.
Wow.
And I was writing all of these ideas down about them in the middle of class. And then I would go home and try to figure out, okay, how can I make this into a story? It started coming together just from those little notes that I would write about these characters and their experiences and their backgrounds.
Your Six of Crows, it's being dubbed like a Harry Potter and a Game of Thrones. And I'd like to throw in Ocean's 11. I'm very curious if you can share with the listeners and myself how you're able to flesh out this world, this whole, like the details, my God, I know this is a fully loaded question, the language, the different names, like you're making up these new words but it works.
Thank
like,
you.
I feel like a dumbass reading your book because I'm like, I have to read it over.
Well, then my goal has been achieved. But all 3 years to feel as stupid as possible.
Jesus, this is what kids are reading nowadays. Oh my God, I need to go back to school.
The thing to remember about Six of Crows, if you like it, is that it was
It is really a book that got better on revision. You know, I wrote that first 30,000 word draft slash outline, whatever you want to call it. And the final draft of Six of Crows is 130,000 words. So that should give you an idea of the way that I work. I start with a bare bone structure and then I add everything in. And I just keep going back and doing that until I have a book. That said, there were plenty of times in the process where I thought, wow, this is a great idea for a book. Ocean's 11 meets Game of Thrones. Magical heist. And then I would think, I really wish somebody else would write this book because I'm not smart enough to do it. And it took many rounds of my own revision, like on my own working the draft and working the draft and working the draft, and then working with a great editor, Noah Wheeler. I think we went through, I would say like 2.5, maybe 3 rounds of revision on it before I remember on that final round being like, oh, now it's fun again. Like, now I believe in this story again. But that was a very long process of not feeling that way, of feeling like the book wasn't good enough, of feeling like I had bitten off more than I could chew. I guess I would say, you know, in terms of world building, my best advice to people is don't psych yourself out. Like, there are people who build entire worlds before they ever write a sentence, okay? And that is totally fine. Like, they make maps and they create entire languages, and that is great. The only thing I would say is, if that's your style, don't let it keep you from writing the draft, okay? Because world building can become a place to hide where we don't actually have to see the story play out on the page. So I'm not particularly like that. For me, the plot and the characters really come first, and then I begin to build in the world, and then the world really impacts the plot and characters. In this case, you know, Ketterdam, this city, this kind of hyper-capitalist merchant city with this thriving criminal underworld, had been in the back of my head for a long time. And so I sort of had the pleasure of then just putting a character into a scene and being like, all right, where is this happening? What are they seeing as they're walking down the street? And when I write my first drafts, I don't fill in a lot of things like names and town names and language and even some bits of description. I will put a placeholder there or a gesture to what I think it's going to be. But I try not to lose my momentum when I'm working. Because, I turn off the internet. I'm not going to go research that thing right then. I'm going to try to get to the next thing that I know, and then I'm going to come back. And I don't know if that's the best way to do it, but it's the way that works for me. So, you know, I'm very proud of Six of Crows. I'm really happy with where it ended up. But it is not, you know, it was not some kind of magical draft that came out that way. It started with an idea I was excited about. I sold it on proposal, and I had this kind of golden mean of a book in my head that I was working towards the whole time. But it took a long time for me to fall back in love with that story. So if you are working on something and you are feeling that way, please know that everybody feels that way. That there is no... Sometimes I think all the questions we ask about process, all of the books, all of that are because the reason we're obsessed with it is because we hope that somehow something will spare us the pain of writing a book.
Just facing it, yeah.
Yes, and feeling lost when you're in it and feeling stuck when you're in it and feeling incompetent when you're in it. Because if writing is your calling, then why does it not only feel like a job, but like a job you're terrible at? Like this is the reality for almost every author I know. In fact, every author I know. I imagine there's somebody out there who's just like, yeah, man, I write, it's great, I'm happy. I have not met that person. one of the best things about becoming a published author has been meeting many of my idols and learning that they all struggle with this feeling and with the process of getting the book to be the story that they want to tell. So let yourself off the hook and just keep writing, keep revising, keep going back to it.
Thank you. And how long was your research phase for this book?
I had to really research as I was writing. So when I was on that retreat, when I was, you know, zero drafting, I was also reading a lot. And also when I knew that this was going to be the next project that I took on. So when I was revising Ruin and Rising and when I was touring and so forth, I was also reading then. So it's hard for me to say exactly how long I took for research, but unfortunately I don't have the luxury of just carving out time that is set for research anymore. It's just not. And it's hard because I got an idea the other day that I really want to write, and it would mean taking a few months and really digging into the research. And I'm hoping that, you know, young adult has a very fast turnaround, especially if you're locked into a series. People really want to see a book a year from you, or, you know, a book every 2 years. And I get that, but it's, you know, this is not an idea that I think I'd be able to turn around that quickly. So you end up, it's a wonderful problem to have.
Yeah, but I can't imagine that pressure at the same time, you know?
You know, it is, there are people who can write 2 books a year and three books a year even, and I salute them. It's incredible. It is fantastic. But it's too easy to fall into the process or the experience of thinking, oh, you know, I should be this kind of writer or that kind of writer. You're going to be the kind of writer that you are. And there are people who can generate vast quantities of words quickly. And then there are people like me who cannot. And, you know, Jandy Nelson had a 6 or 7 year gap between books. She's one of my, I don't read a ton of contemporary, but God, she's such a fantastic author. If you haven't read her, you absolutely should. But her books take a long time, and a lot of authors are like this. It is okay. There are different models of both creativity and success that are out there.
And that wraps up a roundup of interviews with Jacqueline Woodson, Victoria V.E. Schwab, Rita Williams-Garcia, Jeff Zentner, Angie Thomas, and Leigh Bardugo. Almost every writer, if not all, goes through some kind of block, and it's always reassuring to know that even the authors you admire go through the same exact thing. I hope this episode inspired you and makes you feel less alone. Head over to the show notes page at 88cupsoftea.com/podcast/roundup for the links to the full interviews for each author. If you enjoyed this roundup episode, I would love to ask you for your support in taking a moment to subscribe to 88 Cups of Tea on iTunes and leave a rating and a review. Producing a podcast takes a lot of time, and we put a lot of heart and soul into making 88 Cups of Tea the best that it can be. When you take those specific actions of subscribing, leaving a rating and a review, that really helps our show become more visible to new listeners who haven't heard of us before, and we're really trying to get the word out about our podcast. Thank you so much for helping us grow our community. And don't forget to join our private Facebook group if you want to hang out with fellow listeners from 88 Cups of Tea. And not only is it a place for you to talk about your writing, but it's also a place where I ask you for your input, which will directly influence the podcast. As an example, I ask listeners to let me know which were their top favorite motivating episodes so I can list it on our website at 88cupsoftea.com. I ended up pulling from the same listener feedback to influence who I featured in today's roundup of interviews. So if you'd love to give your input for future questions that will directly shape 88 Cups of Tea, or if you want a loving space to talk about the progress of your writing, you can find us at facebook.com/groups/88cupsoftea. I can't wait to meet you in there, and have an amazing rest of your week, and I'll catch you in the next episode. Hey guys, it's me again. Thanks so much for listening in on 88 Cups of Tea. Go create something magical today, and I'll catch you in the next episode. Bye.